All right, good morning. Today we're doing, I'm instead of Rabbi Liban today, apparently, I don't know why, for whatever reason, I'm here. So we're doing Parshat Yitro, or Parshas Yisro, depending on how you pronounce it, and I'm pretty excited about it. This happens to be the only Parsha in the whole Torah that's named after a convert, and here I am teaching it. How nice is that? Yeah, but this is an important parsha because this is the parsha that we received the Torah in. There's all kinds of good stuff in this parsha. So I printed up a little sheet because I like to do that. And I'm not quite sure how Rabbi Liban does it. Do you read first? Do you just discuss?
Sometimes we discuss in one sentence.
Okay, great.
And just ask questions and talk about random stuff or.
So first I want to introduce you to one of my favorite teachers. That's Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. He writes in the mid-1800s, and I really like reading his commentary. First of all, it's written in German, so, I mean, it's of course translated into English, but the sentences themselves are of literary quality and beautiful to read. But he really addresses so many interesting things. So this is his book on, there's seven books in the series because Leviticus is divided into, and there's one on the Haftorahs also. So this is the one on Exodus. So I brought some of his commentary to share. So I think I'll start with that then. So this is the story, basically, of this parsha is first Moses comes back to his father-in-law, Yitro, however you want to call him. And it says Yitro heard what went on in Egypt, so everybody pretty much in the area surrounding heard what went on. It was big news. The plagues and all that stuff. But then Moshe comes back and fills him in on the story, what actually happened. And then the children of Israel are already out, and his father-in-law comes to see his son-in-law in action, as father-in-laws sometimes do, and realizes things are not going so well for him. He's all day long teaching and judging and deciding what to do with the people. And he says, this is not good for you. You're like with everybody all the time. It's too much. You've got to delegate the work and appoint judges. And he tells him judges of tens, of fifties, of hundreds, and of thousands. And so we'll hopefully talk about that. And then after he gets that all settled and the judges are appointed, then it's time to receive the actual book. Right, so we've come out, but it opens, the opening scene of this parsha is before we've received the Torah, but after we've gotten out of Egypt. So what's going on in between? And then we receive the Torah. Ten commandments is in this parsha. And then it finishes up with a few things. So that's the basic storyline.
So can you tell me, ask a little bit about the father-in-law? Like, who was he, and why was he so wise, and how was
this? It's a really interesting question, because this particular father-in-law, he's first introduced as a Kohen Midian. So a Kohen. A Kohen is often translated as priest. And that's really the right translation, even though we in America think of priest as Catholic. But it doesn't mean, it's not really associated with Catholicism. Priest means a religious functionary.
But how could he have been a religious functionary before we got him?
He was a Kohen Midian. He's a Midianite priest. So he was a non-Jewish, other religion priest. That's who he was. So he was a seeker of religions. He's known as somebody who was seeking truth, and he went through many religions, even as a religious functionary in different religions. So that's how he's introduced, as a priest of another religion. And so it's interesting that Moses marries into this family, right? Because here he is, thinking about it, and I don't have an answer to this, I'm just throwing out the question, but thinking about Moshe, we do know from earlier things, and you've probably learned, that he wouldn't even nurse from a non-Jewish nursemaid, right, that they had to go call. It worked out that Yocheved was there to be able to, Miriam was there to be able to go call his actual mother to nurse him, because he wouldn't take the milk of a non-Jew, because the Medrash says that the mouth that's going to speak Torah shouldn't be suckled by non-Jewish milk, right? So here he's not even going to nurse from non-Jewish milk, and yet he's marrying the daughter of a Midianite priest. What's that about? Right? When you're supposed to combine your soul with somebody for your lifelong function, And he wouldn't even take that milk. How is he marrying her? So those are interesting questions, and I don't have the answer. I just think it's an interesting thing. So it depends on where they're headed and who they were. Judaism at the time was by choice. Every Jew was by choice at that time. Even those born into the children of Yaakov. So everyone got to choose in or out until this Parsha, until Sinai. So it was all by choice until Sinai. Hi. So
were there then non-children of Israel there?
Yes.
And they considered themselves Jews?
Nobody was Jewish yet.
And did people accept them? Did they follow the...
So that's a really good question, because that's what's going on here. So that's what I want to talk about. That's what is going on here, is people trying to figure it out. So what Rav Hirsch says, so let's just think about it, because it's interesting just to hear, right? So the first thing that goes on, the opening scene is, right, so Moses comes back, tells us, fills in his father-in-law who's sought many different religions and does choose to be part of the Jewish people and now advise his son-in-law. Right? Why does Moses listen to him? Because his father-in-law offers good advice. But it's interesting, and I'll just read you a little bit of what Rav Hirsch says so you can hear his language. So Moses is busy judging everybody. So from these and the following verses, we can get some of the idea of the camp life of our forefathers during the 40 years wandering in the wilderness. From the simple, easy, and quickly accomplished provision of their daily food, the manna, and from the description which Moses gave in Deuteronomy as to the lack of the necessity to procure and make their other requirements, we must come to the conclusion that by far the greater part of their daily lives was entirely free from those activities, which normally would have taken up most of their time. How then did they occupy their time? Right, so think about it. Here are people in the ancient world. There's no shopping. That's how we occupy our time today. And you're laughing, but my father's an urban historian. He lives on the coast of Oregon. He did a whole survey of what people come to the Oregon coast for. What's their favorite activity? He did exit surveys from campgrounds, right? What was your favorite activity while you were here on the campground? Shopping! It was shopping, right? They set up camp, they made their campfires, and then they went to Astoria or Cannon Beach or one of the, and they shopped. Like, that was the favorite thing. So, okay, so that's how we fill our time today. We shop and acquire stuff, right? We, Westerners, certainly, we wealthy people of the modern West, do spend time. I saw a New Yorker cartoon of somebody lying on the couch and a female therapist sitting there with a notepad saying, "Have you considered shopping?" Right, so retail therapy right there. The therapist is suggesting it. So they didn't have that. So forget shopping. So move back into Laura Ingalls' time, right? What did they spend most of their time doing? Actually, it was trying to keep life going, right? Procure food, survive. So they didn't have to do that. Their food is dropped from heaven. And there is no shopping or internet. What do they do all day? Right? They don't have the trying to get food all day. And their clothes even are cleaned by the clouds and grow with them. They don't even have to make new clothes. No knitting, no sewing, no sheep shearing, nothing. What are they doing all day? Right? So that's what he's saying here. What are they doing all day? So they're busy coming to Moses all day long, asking stuff. What are they doing though? Lidrosh Elohim. So I wrote that on here, just so you could see the word. The fourth one. Lidrosh Elohim. So that word is in chapter 18, verse 15, just so you could see that. But Lidrosh is the infinitive of the word darash or drusha. You've heard of a drusha. Drusha is like a dvar Torah. A drash means an interpretation. Or it also means an interpretation. What is that? It's seeking the meaning. So it really means to seek. Lidrosh is to seek something. So it's not to seek like to seek something that you lost. It's to seek like to seek the meaning. It's that specific kind of seeking, of intellectual seeking, not a physical seeking. So you're not seeking the measuring spoons. You're seeking what does it mean, right? So they are seeking Hashem. That was our job in the desert for 40 years, was to make that transition between slaves and leaders. Right, because here we were an oppressed people, and our job is to move into the leaders of the world. How do we make that transition? And just in thinking about, you know, Ed Koch just died, and it's so interesting. I was reading some of his obits, very interesting person. But it talked about, it credited him, and then with a little break, but then continuing on with Giuliani, with turning New York City around. And in the Wall Street Journal today, it said, you know, turning around or reviving a city, something that hasn't yet come to Los Angeles, Detroit, or I forgot what the third one was, meaning New York was a mess, and it's now okay. Very few cities go from that low to stability, and it did, and a lot of it was under the leadership of the mayor. But if you look at some other cities that are in bad shape, so you have to ask, like, how do people go from downtrodden to able to leadership quality, right? And some groups haven't been able to make that bridge, and so they're still languishing as opposed to accomplishing for themselves or even leading others. So that was our job. That's what was going on in the desert, is we had to go from oppressed people to leaders, and we had to get there. So the whole desert was a workshop in accomplishing that. So the first part of the workshop was to receive food from God, learn how to trust God. You can only take that day's worth of food. No more, because more is coming. Yesterday I had a conversation with the Rebbetzin on the west side, who in her earlier life in the east was a personal organizer, a home organizer. And so we were sharing stories of encounters with home organizers. And one person said that for her it's hard to throw things out, but she started to throw things out because she realized that not throwing things out is not trusting God to provide what you'll need when you need it. So she said she wants to make room for the abundance in her life. And the way that she does that is to let go of things that she might need later, but to make way for the abundance, like just to trust that there's going to be what she needs when she needs it. She doesn't have to hang on to each and everything.
What kind of
thing does she want? Whatever. The point is... Right. No. Correct. Oh, so it could be food. She was saying bits of tinfoil, like little things she was saving. Like, I personally also tried to reduce, reuse, recycle. I'll save a piece of tinfoil, you know, because I could reuse that. But I don't feel like it's taking away from my making room for the abundance. But I liked her sentence, to make room for the abundance, and that's what the manna is about. That's what receiving the manna is about. Is that Hashem will provide. Take what you need. You don't have to hoard for tomorrow, because he's going to provide it again tomorrow. And again, and again. It's going to be there for you. So learn to trust Hashem, like a baby learns to trust their mother, that they're going to be there for you and provide for you and give to you. So that was the first part of the workshop, is they're going to, that Hashem will provide for you. You can trust that. So, which is interesting that we had to go through that, because we just came out of 10 miracles, 10 miraculous plagues, and a miraculous exodus, right? We still have to now learn to trust on a daily basis, outside of the, you know, big splash miracles, to trust on a regular day-to-day basis. So 40 years of building that kind of trust, so it starts there. But then inside that trust, what are you supposed to do? So you are supposed to seek Hashem. So looking for God in daily life, looking for how you can be in relationship with God in daily life. So first people did a little bit of their own exploration. How will I start seeking that? And as people came up with their own questions, they started to show up to Moses. Okay, I have a question. How do I do it here? How do I do it there? How do I do it here? How do I do it there? So Yitro looked at that and said, oh, Moses, you're getting way too into the details with way too many people. You've got a point. You've got a great nation full of wise people. Pick some to help everybody out. So, but it's just interesting to think about what was daily life like in the camp and what was going on. So now we have this happening where people are trying to figure out how to be in relationship with Hashem before they actually get the instruction book. And that's really what the Torah is the instruction book on how to use the physical to create a relationship with the spiritual. Right? That's really, if you want to, like, distill the Torah in a nutshell. That's what it is. How to use the physical to create a relationship with the spiritual. So they're trying to figure it out without the instruction book first, because it hasn't come yet. But doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, right? Because we do have the concept of the Torah was created before the world, right? The Torah is the blueprint of the world, right? Have you heard that concept before? Right? So if the Torah is the blueprint of the world, so that means the blueprint's created first, and then the world's created from the blueprint, which means that any architect can sit in this building and derive the blueprint from the building, which means that any spiritually astute person can sit in the world and derive much of Torah from the world. So the fact that there is a way to use the physical to establish a relationship with the spiritual, that exists in the fabric of the world. Even without an instruction book, somebody can derive it. A Stephen Covey, You know, people like that who are astute can derive these things from the world. Others appreciate having teachers, right? So, but everybody is actually empowered with that ability, with the intellect that we have to deduce certain things from the environment that we're in. And we're required to do that, to use the tools that we have.
So you don't think that this nation of people who were former slaves, who had no sense of what it was to rule themselves, they weren't concerned with petty things like your tent is too noisy after 10 o'clock or your children are very annoying to me.
I think they may have been. That may be the case as well, that they're judging little disputes like that. Because the truth is, we are supposed to be a nation, a full, complete nation that leads the way in the world. And that's why we're supposed to have a state. You know, so what's the point of a state? But if we're a religion and a people of leaders, why do we need a state? And yet we clearly see that a chunk of land, not just as a reservation that we should be safe there, but that chunk of land is a very special piece of land that is at the convergence of three continents and an ocean through which the routes of trade flowed for millennia, and even now digitally through which the routes of trade flow, right? That it's a very important placement in the world. So really what it is that the ideas of the Jews are supposed to flow with the trade out. So we're supposed to be this multifaceted nation that sets a precedent. So yes, we are supposed to have families and be lawyers and have street cleaners and musicians. And it's not just supposed to be a bunch of priests, right? It's supposed to be people who do everything and live in a way that shines brilliantly to others to show the way. So we'll see that towards the end of the parsha. So meanwhile, what they're coming to Moses to learn is the derech. So the word is used, derech. Let's see if I could find that for you. Who knows what the word derech is?
Pathway.
Good. A pathway or a route. A derech is a route or a pathway. So today, the word is used in religious circles to refer to kids who leave the path. They're off the derech, right? So a kid who's no longer observant, who was raised in a religious family, who's no longer observant, would be called off the derech, or, since there's so many of them, OTD, right? Mm. there's already initials for them, off the derech, okay? So the question is, what's the derech? Right, so we have a derech. A derech is a pathway or a way to. So it's a way to achieve your goals, right? Whatever your goals are. So the derech in Torah language is the Torah way to achieve the goals of being a Torah community, being who we're supposed to be. So, but we also have this concept of what's derech eretz. Have you ever heard of derech eretz? So derech, who can define that? Derech eretz. Okay, so literal Hebrew translation would be the way of the land, the way to the land, derech eretz. But what's the idiomatic translation to have derech eretz?
Like morality.
Good, manners, good manners, or good behavior, derech eretz. So you might even hear grandparents in Yiddish, they might say it too, because it is a Yiddish phrase as well as Hebrew. I mean, it's Hebrew, but it's also part of Yiddish, derech eretz, have derech eretz. Like you have to teach a kid derech eretz, and somebody might not behave with you with derech eretz. You know, to behave properly, to behave nicely, that's derech eretz. So manners, derech eretz has two other meanings also though. So it also means sexuality, because that's the way of the earth, derech eretz, the way of the earthiness. And it also means making a living, derech eretz, the way of the land, that you have to engage in the way of the land in order to make a living. So in Pirkei Avot, there's a phrase, derech eretz kadma latorah, right? So that's why I wanted to give you these few different translations. Derech eretz kadma latorah. So I wrote this in here for you because I want these words to be there for you. So derech, a pathway, derech eretz, manners, or whatever else it means. And then we have this phrase, derech eretz kadma latorah. Derech eretz precedes the Torah. So what does that mean? Derech eretz precedes the Torah. Because we know that Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. The Torah is supposed to be everything. It's instead of everything. It's more important than anything. So how could you say that Derech Eretz comes before the Torah? Right? That takes precedence or it precedes or what does that mean? So it was interesting. I heard our rabbi on the west side, they just did a Derech Eretz panel at Hillel Academy for the middle school girls. So I said, how do you explain this? He said, it's like So he's trying to think of a parable that works for middle school girls. It's like when you make a cake, right? So you make a cake. What's the most important thing? The cake, right? And you have flour and sugar and salt and rising agent and whatever flavor you're going to put in it. But if you don't have a bowl to mix it in, you can't make a cake. So the bowl precedes the cake. Even the cake is the most important thing. Without the bowl, which is not important to the cake, but essential to the cake, right? You can't have a cake without a bowl. That's what Derek Arendt says. Okay, so I liked what he said, but let's move it a little further into adulthood, okay? So Torah is essential. Torah is compared to water. It's so essential, right? It is really the foundation of our life. And it's even compared to water. Like there's all kinds of parables, like being a fish in water. We are like fish in water, and we shouldn't leave the water. All kinds of different things you'll hear. So Torah is compared to water. But what about water? Water has no shape, right? Water takes on the shape of anything that it's poured into. So Derech Eretz comes before the Torah. Derech Eretz is the shape of us, our midos, right? So a mida is really, it means a character trait. Midos, midot means character traits, but it really means measurement. What are our measurements? How are we measured? Like in Mary Poppins, when she says, "How do you measure up?" Remember that scene? Right, where she measures up each child, she has a measuring tape. But when she measures them, it says what their midos are, what their measurements are, what their character traits are. Of course, hers is Mary Poppins, practically perfect in every way, right? So, but the other kids have a measurement, right? A little bit ornery, a little bit sleepy, a little bit whatever it is, but they have their measurements. That's what our midot are, is our how we measure up. It's the container that we are. That's what Derech Eretz is the container that we make ourselves into. And then you pour Torah into that. So Torah is only as beautiful as the container into which it's poured. So somebody who has very poor Derech Eretz, their Torah is ugly. And somebody who has beautiful Derech Eretz, their Torah is spectacular. So really, Derech Eretz kadma la Torah. You can't have Torah without Derech Eretz. Or the Torah, the container. So you have to create the container first. But it's also literal, right? So now we understand it that way, but it's also literal. We have here the Derech Eretz that precedes the receiving of the Torah. That's what's going on here, is they're trying to figure out how should we behave? How should we act in this new reality where we're no longer slaves, but we're not employed, right? So what are we supposed to be doing? We're supposed to be seeking a relationship with Hashem and everything that we're doing. How do we do that? What's the Derech Eretz of us? How should we behave physically? The behavior of the land, what is that for us right now? How are we supposed to do this? And that's the question that precedes the giving of the Torah. So in this case, also, Derech Eretz precedes the Torah. So figuratively and literally, it is in this parsha. Okay, any questions on that so far before we go ahead? Okay. All right, so now we have the receiving of the Torah. So then there's the appointing of the judges. So that's just one interesting thing that I want to mention here that Rav Hirsch points out. If you have judges, right, you have 600,000 people, 600,000 men. So we're not going to go into men, women, all that stuff right now. But 600,000 men. From that, you're going to appoint judges of the tens, of the fifties, of the hundreds, and the thousands. Which, if you add it up, which I didn't, but Rav Hirsch did, the total number of judges may seem surprisingly large. The actual number appointed here would be 78,600, so that every seventh or eighth man in Israel was a judge. But every man who lived an honest life and who had some knowledge of the law, the Torah, which wasn't given yet, so clearly the Torah is derivable, right? Everyone who has some knowledge of the law was called upon to be a judge in Israel. Actually, every man in Israel is expected to live an honest life and not be ignorant of the law. And the whole nation, every individual of the nation, was considered a bearer and representative of the law to such an extent that any three right-living men of the people could come together to form a court and could judge any detail of rights and enforce the observation of all rights. So we do see that is the law, that any three Torah-observant men can come together and form a court at any time. They're empowered with that. There's no special thing for that.
It's pretty idyllic. I mean,
it is.
Okay. I mean, you know, we all live in society. We all know that everyone has different perspectives, and also it's hard to believe that everyone really does have a righteous perspective. So, are we to believe that these people are extraordinarily good, or
we're hoping that that's what it's supposed to be? It is supposed to be that if everyone is leading a Torah life, then they are going to be somebody who has, and that's why you have a court of three, not one. So you do balance each other that way. It's for sure susceptible to corruption in the regular world of people. So we're right now living in a state of gullus, of exile. What exile means is distance between who we are and who we wish we were. That's really what it is, right? So, because even in the land of Israel, people are living in exile because we don't have the temple there and we don't have, God's presence is not manifest, really. So we are still all living in dissonance between who we are and who we wish we should be. So the Torah here is describing what we could be. And so we need to know what to be aiming for, but we're definitely living in dissonance. So while we have Beit Dins today, we have a corrupt system today too, unfortunately. So that's the reality, and we need to fix it. We for sure need a healing in our nation in many different sectors, and that's one of them. If anybody wants to sign up, there's an interesting new quarterly that just came out called Klal Perspectives, K-L-A-L, Perspectives. And it's a symposium magazine that examines one issue per quarter, usually putting three or four questions out there and then inviting 15 or so different authors to answer those same questions. So this past issue was on Kiruv, on outreach and what's going on in that field. And the next issue is going to be on Beit Dins. The previous issue was on the skyrocketing divorce rate in young observant couples. So it's just examining the different issues that affect the observant community, and trying to, sunshine is the best disinfectant, as they say, bring things to light so they can be discussed and thought about, which is a new thing in the observant world, discussing things out in the open, even amongst ourselves. So they're working on it. So Klal Perspectives online, you can get it for free and download the whole thing if you're interested. Now we've appointed our judges and the multiple people that can be judges, and we just see what the nation can be. And now it's time to receive the Torah. So it's interesting, in thinking about receiving the Torah, what happens? The first thing they do is set up a separate space. God says, this is the mountain I'm going to give the Torah on. Stay off of it. I'm going to elevate this physical space into a transphysical reality for a short period of time, in which nothing physical may come into contact. I mean, it's the mountain, but no animals or people are allowed to touch it. Set up barriers so everybody knows. Don't come to this mountain. And separate yourselves sexually. Don't go near a woman for 3 days, right? So you're separating yourself from Derech Eretz, right, in that sense. And you're separating yourself physically from the mountain so this is what Rav Hirsch says, and I didn't think about this, so that the law can come from outside, not from inside. So I like this, I'll review the way he phrases it. For the Jewish law, the Torah, is the only one that did not emanate from the people whose constitution it was to form. Judaism is indeed the one religion that did not spring from the breasts of men who find the spiritual basis of their lives in it. It is just in this objectivity of the Jewish Torah, the Jewish religion, that makes it unique of its kind, that differentiates it sharply and specifically from everything other on the earth that is called law and religion, that allows it to be the one center point of culture, which may be regarded as the lever and the culminating goal of every other advance and progress, but itself as the given absolute ideal to be above all ideas of progress. So he goes on to say, all other religions emanate from the thoughts of men, that they are thinking, how can we create a system in which people will, whatever their goal is, either behave kindly towards one another, or help the world, or be in subservience to the divine, whatever it is, whatever the goal is, but people are thinking about in committee how to accomplish this. And here it's quite clear that making this separate space is saying, law's not coming from you. You're not thinking about it. It's not up to you. I'm going to pronounce it down to you so that it is separate and distinct from your thoughts and where you want to go. So that it's just given to you. So, and it's interesting, as he discusses here also, that part of the desert experience, I mean, here we are, the stiff-necked people, right? That's part of our branding. We're chutzpahdik. We're a chutzpahdik people, and we're labeled that, stiff-necked people. So we don't agree with the law, and we get it. You know, I mean, there's another, I love the New Yorker. There's so many great comics in there. So there's one with Moses looking up saying, "You want us to cut our what?" Right? But that but that really embodies, like, so much. Like, we're like, what? We should soak and salt our meat? Really? We should kill things in this way? Really? Like, that's how we're supposed to marry? That's how we're supposed to... We're not supposed to mix these fibers? You care about fibers? You know, like, linen and wool? Really? Like, there, we have so many questions on God. Like, what are you telling us to do? Build this, don't build that. It has to be hewn stone, not... I mean, it shouldn't be hewn stone. It should be, you know, put together stones. It should be like... You should build a ramp instead of steps. That's the end of this. A ramp instead of steps up to the altar so that your nakedness shouldn't be seen, right? Because you're supposed to... shouldn't step up steps that might expose. I was thinking about it. I was in the Shabbaton that I was in last week. It was in a hotel, and this... everybody takes the stairs, right? Because Shabbos... But the stairs there weren't carpeted stairs. They're the kind of stairs that were like one board after another. So as women are going up, you could see a lot. You know, like, it's not really the most modest thing when you're on the bottom and the way, like, because there's no, like, there's, you can see up the steps, right? So, but even if you can't see up the steps, when you, even just stepping up a step, when you pick up your leg to step up a step, it does raise your skirt and you can see more leg than not, right? So, one of the things God says is build the Kohen's wearing a long robe to the floor, but it says build a ramp, not steps, so that you'll be more modest, right? So you're just moving up slowly instead of taking steps up. Really, God cares about the steps and the ramp. Like, there's so many different things that he's legislating here. So, and we reject a lot of it, and it takes us, actually, I was going to say 40 years, but really still today. Right? We're still working on accepting it, what God gave us, because we are a chutzpahic people. And yet, without the chutzpah, we would never be here. There's no way that throughout Jewish history, when you look backwards and see what we've been through, we would never be here without the heavy dose of chutzpah that's carried us through all these generations. So we need that chutzpah for sure to make it through, and... we had a lot going on between us and God and the chutzpah that, you know, it's still playing out, all this chutzpah. So so the Torah is given, right? So everybody stays away. It's everybody's separated from the space. The space is elevated. The people prepare themselves. They even prepare their clothing, wash their clothing, dip everything in a mikvah. Mikvah started at that time. The whole, what that means, the ritual immersion of the whole thing. It's interesting when... a few different people have expressed to me, and I never really thought about it, what it's like growing up religious, right? Since I didn't, but I did raise kids who grew up religious. So what it's like growing up religious and less exposed, thinking about going to the mikvah. So many of us have seen pictures of mikvahs, or maybe, I don't know if you've had a mikvah tour and seen one, but so my boss told me that the first time she was on Masada as a teenager, they showed them these, you know, muddy pits, and said, look, they had mikvahs that are just the same as today, meaning the halachic shape was the same as today. She's thinking, oh. Ew, a muddy pit. So as she's getting ready to get married and they're telling her she's going to go to a mikvah, she's thinking, I've seen those. Blah, right? And my daughter told me, I've taken her to the mikvah many times to dip dishes, because you're supposed to dip dishes before you use them, right? So she's seen the mikvah for dishes, but she had never seen the other one. So as she's getting ready to get married, she's told she has to go to the mikvah, she's thinking, it's cold, it's dirty, it's shallow, it's not private. Ew! So, but it's not. The one for people is much nicer and warm and private. But, like, just, you know, just to think about what kids think, what they absorb and what they think. Anyway, so the mikvah laws start here, where they actually do all go to mikvahs and they dip their clothes in a mikvah too. So there is this connection with the water, this... this pre, if you look in the first days of creation, water is not mentioned as a creation. Water was created before the world was created. So when you go to the mikvah, you're really tapping into pre-world existence so that you can go back deep below creation and emerge a new creature again. So that's what was going on, is they went into this pre-creation state and came back out ready to be recreated in the receiving of the Torah. So this is a pivotal moment, of course, in Jewish history. So the last few parshas, we're learning that this is all about how do we transition from non-Jewish to Jewish. That's what's going on, right? So the first step of the process is to go into Egypt. and to be squeezed tight, right? So we're squeezed out so that the regularness of us is removed, but then we're left with just shreds of who we were because we've been oppressed and squeezed so tightly, and now we have to integrate something new into us so that we've had something exit, something remain, and now we're brought in that squeezed state to Mount Sinai to absorb the Torah.
Wait, but you said, where exactly do they say, but I say the phrase, wash the clothing and let them be prepared, but where does it say mikveh?
It doesn't say the word mikveh, that's what washing the clothing is.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the oral explanation, but that's what they did. They separated and they removed themselves a little bit from being so physical and went through this process of everybody. And that mikveh is considered the mikveh of conversion. Because here they are, non-Jews, becoming Jewish. Right? So how does a non-Jew become Jewish? They have to accept the Torah, get circumcised, and go to the mikveh. Right? Or for a woman, just two steps, right? Accept the Torah, go to the mikveh. So all the men were already circumcised in Egypt. And there's all kinds of stuff about that because there really is a second circumcision that takes place right before going into the land. So it's a question like exactly, you can't do it twice, really. So what was that? It's all kinds of interesting things. It's a whole different conversation. Maybe I'll get there if you want to ask me later. but here they do have to go to the mikveh and receive the Torah. So that maybe it's a different order than the way we usually do it. We do it, receive the Torah first, go to the mikveh second. But that's what's going on here. The truth is halacha, actual Jewish law, not current practice, but actual law is you can convert accepting the concept of the Torah without knowing its details. So, but that was only in the olden days when really you lived in a shtetl world, right? So if you were converting and there were very few converts, where would you live? Only in the shtetl. You couldn't. There was no life like today where you could have a foot in many worlds, forget two worlds, but in many, and where you had, where you could be a nothing or a part something, right? At that time, like let's say 300 years and before, you were this or that. There was no gray area in between at all. So if you went from Gentile to Jewish, you had to abandon everything that was there, including your family, and move into the Jewish world where everybody was keeping this. Not even, even if people were less educated, more educated, less believers, more believers, but there was no such thing as a non-observant or a non, or an atheist Jew. Like that was, it just didn't exist at the time, right? So if you moved into the Jewish community, you for sure were keeping all this, so you were helped along the way. But today, they really require everybody learning everything up front because you're not living in such a rich community when you make that transition step. So today, there's the requirement to learn much more. But really, the halacha requires general acceptance of the Jewish pathway, mikveh, and then continued learning. Today, we do a chunk of learning first and then mikveh. So really, this is the way that's according to halacha. So mikveh and then Torah. So so they receive the Torah. Okay, so now you get these 10 commandments. But it turns out, it's an interesting thing, that in receiving the 10 commandments, even though it lists the 10 here, that what our oral law teaches us is that really only the first two were heard by the entire nation. Because the experience was so traumatic that coming into contact with God's presence, because it was God's self that revealed God's self to the people in creating this expression of the commandment, whether it was sounds or sights, and it talks about seeing the voices, right? So what that means, I'll tell you that in just a minute. So, but that the experience is so completely overwhelming that our souls left us. So we did the first commandment, we died. Everybody. And then we were revived, so we could hear the second commandment. Hear the second commandment, we died. And then we were revived to hear the third commandment. And everybody said, having two deaths is enough. This is really difficult. Do you mind, Moses, if you could just listen for us and you'll let us know? Because we're pretty clear of what's going on at this point. We know it's God. We know he's telling us, but it's really traumatic to hear it on our own. So so that's what we understand, is that after that, the people did ask Moses to be the intermediary between God and us because it was too intense an experience. Well, let's just talk about the experience, because I did write down here, saw the sounds, which it says in chapter 20, verse 15. They saw the sounds. So what is the difference between hearing and seeing? Thinking about those two differences, not just the different sight and different senses, but they work differently, right? So hearing is linear. You hear one sound after another. You don't hear it all at once. You have to hear in a linear progression and then put it together. Whereas seeing is a whole, all-encompassing experience. You see everything all at once. And then usually what you have to do is focus on something, like take the wide experience and bring it down into what you're trying to look at, whether it's one person or one part of a person or one piece of the experience. But seeing is broad and all at once, whereas hearing is specific and linear. So you have to, hearing, you have to hear each sound and let it add up into something. And seeing, you see the whole thing at once and then have to figure out what it means. Right? So seeing the sounds when we receive the Torah is referring to our senses blending and being able to hear as if we're seeing. Like experiencing the hearing, the thunder and the noise of receiving the Torah as sight. That we got it all at once. That it wasn't a linear and therefore more easily processable experience. It was all at once blast of information through sound so that it felt like sight, right? But it wasn't a linear kind of a thing. So it was a sensory overload, which is one reason for the death, right? It was too much. And then there had to be the revival. And then again, seeing the sound, so it was too much. So we do have different ways of comprehending the world, but in this case, it was a sense of, and that's what the verse says, seeing the sounds. There is such a thing as tablets. Where is that? It would be good if I knew exactly where that was.
That's here, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's coming down with the tablets, but the tablets of the law, but this is not where he breaks them. That is, where is that? Because then we get much more law. The sin of the golden calf is really where he comes down with the tablets. So he comes down with the law.
But that's after this.
That's after this. Yes. Yeah.
So the tablets were just kind of
so we have tablets of the law. That's the written expression. It's interesting really to think about, and I don't have the full answer on exactly how I got it, but we definitely understand, and it is one of our 13 principles of faith, that the book of the Torah that we have today, the scroll, the words that are on the scroll, is the same Torah that we got at that time. And yet, on the mountain at that time, we did not get that whole scroll at once. We got the tablets. So we do call them Luchot HaBrit, the tablets of the covenant. And the 10 commandments, and that's why I wrote here 10 and 14. It's really 14 mitzvahs, so it's 14 commandments in 10 statements. So we, in Hebrew, call it the Aseret HaDibrot, the 10 statements, not the 10 commandments. That's a Christian calling of it.
I think I have the same question. Mm-hmm. So you just answered it to say that. But I guess I don't understand. I feel half embarrassed asking this, but I'd rather know than not.
Yeah, for sure.
How it is that the Torah, which we're reading,
right,
was given to them.
Great
as
question.
Sort of like, hey, here's what just happened. It's like,
right,
it's like this is the current episode of,
it's like Star Wars, where you start in the middle and then you go back.
Yeah. It's like, and here also in the Torah is everything's going to happen for a while.
Right, exactly.
And here's a book and this is where what it says.
Definitely needs to be asked. There's no question about it. So there is a theory that it's like Star Wars.
Self-referential. Like,
yes, so good. No, so it's very important to ask. So one theory is that it's like Star Wars, that it was revealed all at once, and that it was forwards and backwards, but that the people didn't really have access to the whole thing until the whole story was done. And particularly the end of it, that recounts Moses' death. Mm-hmm. There's questions about the last 8 verses. Who wrote those? Was it Moses that channeled those verses himself about his death? Or Joshua, who took over from him, did he fill in the end of the Torah? So that's really not the 5 books of Moses, but the 4 and 98th, so, hundredths.
So it's an open question whether or not...
No,
the,
it's not.
Okay. although it doesn't say so in the narrative specifically, it is...
So the question is, how do we get the whole thing? So
yeah, it's understood that they got it all.
It's understood that they got it all, but maybe not at that very second. So that's why I think it's really important. Right, so we got the 10 commandments there, and it seems that there were other times that chunks got revealed. So the question is what? Right. So I think this is what, I mean, and we know that the book that we have today is the book they got at the time, and the whole thing was codified and set down at the end of the desert experience for sure. So did they get chapters along the way? That's a possibility. Okay. So, so that's why I like to distill what is the Torah that we got. The Torah means law, right? It also has in the center of it, phonetically, not spelling-wise, the letters don't work out, but the word or, Torah, right? Usually we don't pronounce it Torah. Don't pronounce it that way, because then it marks you as somebody who doesn't know Torah. It's Torah, right? Like a tow truck. Torah, right? So not Torah. So Torah. But, pardon? I guess, unless you're from Boston. But the center is or, right? So the light, if we're supposed to be a light unto the nations, where do we get the light but from the Torah? We get it from the or that's there. Okay, so but what is this? What are we supposed to be accomplishing? What is this book? So that's why I like to distill it into the one sentence that it is, the physical pathway to creating a relationship with the spiritual. That's what the Torah is. How do you do it? Right? Here you are in the physical, and you have to get spiritual. How do you do it? This is the book that tells you how to do it. That's what it's about. It's a book of law. It's a book of history. It's a book of, but it's not just history. It's not science. But it does have some things that touch on science and some things that touch on history, but you can't learn history from it, and you can't learn science from it. You can learn law from it, but not straight up. We don't really, there's nothing in the Torah pretty much that we do that just from where it says here, or we have the whole oral law that goes with the whole thing. So what is it? But if you understand it as the gateway into using the physical to create a relationship with the spiritual, that's what it is. That's what we got on Sinai, on Mount Sinai, is this is how you do it in a package. We got an oral law and a written law all at once. How it got actually written down, I'm still a little bit unclear myself, but it certainly happened in the desert. And I believe that there are different explanations of how it actually coalesced into the five books that we have today, but it happened then, but not at this spot in the story. So this spot in the story. But then Moses goes up for 40 days after. So it's possible he got the whole thing at that time, including his death.
So the five books of Moses go through like four elements.
No, they don't.
So sorry.
No problem.
How far does the Torah go?
Until Moses' death.
Okay. And
entrance into the land, right? So basically, Moses dies, and the people are still in the desert, right? Right on the edge. It's the end of the 40 years. Moses dies. They're about to enter into the land to start the new chapter in their lives, and that's where the Torah ends. And that's where the prophets begin, with Joshua, who takes over the leadership from Moses and brings them into the land, because that's the whole new chapter. Now, leaving behind the leadership of the one, going out from under the leadership of the one who is in direct communication with God in a way that no other prophet ever has been able to be in that type of communication, and then moving under the leadership of somebody else who's bringing them not just out of the leadership transition, but out of the workshop transition, because now you're leaving the 40 years of the desert and the workshop of transition between slavery and leadership, or the phase one of that workshop, because in a way we're still in that workshop, right? But we're going into the next phase, which is now inhabiting the land and trying to figure out how now to be in relationship with God without a full day to study, because now you have to plow the earth and get food out of it instead of it coming down from heaven. So now how do you make this Emunah workshop that we've been in for the last 40 years of trusting God in the everyday, how do you make that work as a farmer? Right? How do you bring that level into where we're holding today? How do you make it work as a banker? How do you make it work as a teacher? Right? How do you make it work in our lives? We're still doing that.
So but there are all kinds of, and I might be getting the oral law and the written law mixed up, but there are, I mean, this covers how we're supposed to live our life outside of the desert. It has all the laws of, the temple and how to groom your fields.
It does have a lot, but it does not have all the practical stuff.
Right. Well, that's
at all. That's the oral law.
But was all of that, like the Star Wars example, so was all of that given to us before we needed to use it?
So a lot was, but a lot was given in principles. So we do have the concept of the oral law continuing to unfurl. So principles were given, but then how does that apply? So for instance, keeping Shabbos, right? So how do you keep Shabbos? So it says it juxtaposes keeping Shabbos with building the tabernacle. So right? So basically we learn from that through the oral law that keeping Shabbos means not doing anything that it took to build the tabernacle. Divide that into 38 kinds of work, because the 39th kind of work that we can't do on Shabbos has to do with carrying, and that has to do with remembering the exodus from Egypt, leaving one domain into another. So that's the 39th. But the other 38, they're all about building the tabernacle. So we can't do that, right? So sheep shearing, right? So we can't shear sheep. Okay, who has a sheep in their backyard that they're worried about shearing today? None of us, right? And yet, we are all at risk of sheep shearing. And this is what the oral law comes to teach us. What is sheep shearing? Sheep shearing is taking what's growing on a living body and severing it from the living body without killing the body at all, but like taking the growing wool and severing it, right? What about biting your nails? Right? Or your cuticles on Shabbos. What are you doing? Right? That's sheep shearing. That's the law of sheep shearing, is taking what's growing from your body and severing it, right? From the body, from the living body. So that we were given principles, and then we can try to figure them out. Electricity, it didn't exist in the Torah. Is it fire? Fire, for sure, you can't do on Shabbos. Well, it seems like it's not fire, now that we understand more of the science. There were initial rulings that it was fire, because electric light bulbs replaced torches, right, or candles. But then as we understood it more, we understood building circuits, so the science went into it, that completing a circuit, so we don't build either, because we can't build the tabernacle. We don't finish projects on Shabbos either, so we don't finish a circuit being built, so we don't flick a switch, because that builds the circuit, or completes it. But we can certainly use it, right? It can be left on or off the whole time, no problem. So we got principles and how they play forward. So we did get the whole thing, and we have to now do some digging when new situations come up. Artificial insemination, permitted or not? Well, they didn't have that then. Certainly not for human beings. They might have had actual artificial insemination, take the semen from an animal, implant it in a female of the same species. What about crossing, mixing? What about petri dishes? Like, so all that stuff, but it's there. You just have to go digging. So once you go digging and find principles that are there, that relate to that, and then you write about it, you've unfurled it further and unfurled it further. But the unfurling takes coming into contact with new situations. So it does continue to unfurl, and yet the roots of the whole thing were given at that time. Does that help? Sorry. Okay, I have to finish up, so I want to make sure that we point out one more thing here. Because I'm teaching kashas to the bat mitzvah girls in just a minute. Not that. Okay, so I just wanted to do mission. Let's just make sure I went through this whole thing. Okay, so we talked about derech, that's a pathway, derech eretz, what that is, manners, etc. Derech eretz, kadma la Torah. That derech eretz comes before the Torah. Lidrosh elokim, that's what people were doing, seeking God in their everyday. So they appointed judges. He had to distribute the work. Oh, so I didn't talk about this. This is very important. So two last little things. Okay, so in chapter 19, verse 2, when it's talking about the children of Israel traveling through the desert, it uses the plural because it's the children of Israel traveling, right? And then it says, and they encamped before the mountain. But that word, they encamped, vayichan, is in the singular, not in the plural. You can't see that in the English, so you just have to trust me on this. So I wrote it out, vayichan. So before that, it's in the plural. They traveled, they went places, and then they encamped in the singular. So Rashi, of course, the one who asks about grammar all the time, so he says, what's up with the singular when we've been doing plural this whole time? So this is a very classic Rashi. So it's important just to hear this. A classic Rashi on this word is they encamped ke'ish echad belev echad, like one person with one heart. It was a moment of Jewish unity. So much unity that they were able to use the singular in talking about the entire nation. Everybody encamped like one person with one heart. That's where we were holding when we received the Torah. It was a one-heart conglomeration receipt of the Torah at the moment of receiving. Then we went back to ourselves where, you know, we're still trying to work on the unity. But there was that unity at that point, and that was necessary for receiving the Torah. It's interesting to think about, you know, we Jews and how contentious we are, and how we like to split hairs, and how we like to argue with each other, and how we've created a million different groups out of ourselves. And yet still, and while there's some controversy today, let's just move us back, let's say 150 years, we still agree that this is the book, and there's not another book. We don't have different versions of our book. You don't see different groups of Jews that come with different versions of the story or the book. There is no other version of this book among the Jews. We don't have it. Right? So as divided as we are, we do agree that we got the book, and this is the book that we got. Right? So with some question marks today, but basically we definitely, that's something that we agree on as a people, as contentious as we are. So it's interesting to see like who we are and how we think, and yet we do agree on this. I did, yeah.
So what do we say when people say, oh, there's obvious that it's three different
biblical
writers.
Criticism.
That drives me crazy.
Yeah, so that's the biblical critics of the late 1800s, which they're interesting to listen to, and they are coming from, and I wish I knew enough history to really talk about this intelligently, but I know Rav Hirsch is also coming from that place, trying to use proofs from the inside to prove different things rather than from the outside to show, because he is opposing a lot of that scholarship that's been done at the time. So we just have to wait. We'll just have to be patient, because part of their process is to disprove religion. It's interesting to see what they did to the Christians, what they did to the Jews, and that they wanted to do it to the Muslims too, but were not able to, because as they started to collect manuscripts, the word went out in the Muslim world, this has to be stopped, and access was ended, and those people who even had some photographs of different manuscripts that were going out, the projects were, either people were killed. I saw there was a whole long article in the Wall Street Journal a few years ago about the transmission of this information that was set up for biblical criticism of the Islamic text, and how the kibosh was put on that in multiple generations. And finally, because so many grad students were being knocked off before the Second World War, so one of the professors who had it at the time just said, everything went up in flames in the bombing of Germany, the whole thing is gone. But meanwhile, he did pass it on to somebody who now, I think they're putting it in microfiche and making it available by internet so that it could be available, so that scholarship can happen. Okay, so anyway, getting back to this, so what do we do with that? It's interesting, I just went in Cincinnati 2 years ago. Cincinnati is the mecca of Reform Judaism, for mixed metaphors. So that's where Hebrew Union College is. Even the and I wanted to speak to somebody there instead of reading from Wikipedia. It turns out even the Reform today agree that the Torah is heaven, is divinely inspired. So I said, what does that mean, divinely inspired? Does that mean, like... and I was kind of mean when I said it. I shouldn't have said it this way, but I did. Does that mean like the Christians believe? Heaven breathed? Or does that mean like the Orthodox Jews believe? Moses took dictation. Moses took dictation. God spoke and Moses took dictation. What do you mean divinely inspired, right? So she said more like the first and the second. She didn't want to say like the Christians, but more like the first. But they do believe it's divine, okay? So what do you do with all that biblical criticism? Let them criticize away. They don't have access to what we have access to. And our tradition of how we take the whole thing apart. The more Hebrew you learn, the more you see how each letter is an integral part of the whole message. The more you see there's no way this could be made up. I would say for me, that's the most faith-affirming thing that I engage in, is the study in Hebrew. Because it's one thing to learn it in English. It's nice stories. It's good instruction. It's interesting. Once you start to learn it in Hebrew, you see how every word makes a difference and how every root connects with something else. And the more you see the connections, the more you see there's no way, it's not possible that this could be concocted by human beings. It's not possible. It's unbelievable the intricacy and how all the threads tie into each other and how you hear echoes from one place to another and how Rabbi David Foreman explains how he wants... the Torah asks us to see both stories together, whatever both stories it's referring to, in order to get depth of perception, right? So when you don't have the same perspective if you only are seeing out of one eye. So if you only read one story here, if you only read the story of Joseph without knowing the story of even Esther, right? And you see all the parallels between Joseph and Esther, they're both, you know, they both, that Mordechai becomes like second to the king, Joseph becomes second to the king, they both get the kingly reins, they both get the horse, they both get, and the names that go on it, and all these different things that happen, and you don't see them together, then you don't get the perspective on either story. It's fascinating to see. The more you learn, the more you start to hear little things, and there's all kinds of chiastic stuff too, and I just learned that word. But that means where there's a center point and things flow out from there. So like the blessings of Jacob, when he gives the blessing to all his children, the tribes. So there's a center point, a fulcrum on which the whole thing pivots, and then there's this, and then it flows out from the center that, and I can't tell you the thing because I just learned this, that goes that there's a step here and a step here and a step here, where it creates one whole. You can't see that it's, you can't write a narrative and include that, and with all the right Hebrew, and it's fascinating. The more you learn, the more you see, there's no way. So they're busy with their different voices and literary criticism. But even if you just want to talk about the difference in Christianity and Judaism, we don't have different versions. The Christians have a million different versions. You can't, there's no one authoritative version of the New Testament. It doesn't exist anywhere on the planet. Nobody agrees to one version. But we all agree to this one version. So anyway, I better end because Bat Mitzvah girls are waiting. So thank you very much. And I forgot the mission of the... Okay, one more thing. I have to say this piece. So our mission that's given in this verse right here in 19:6 is that we're supposed to become a priestly kingdom, which means every single one of us is supposed to become a priest. Every single one of us, not just the Kohanim, every single Jew, which means we're all supposed to become religious functionaries, which means we're all supposed to be people who connect the divine with who? The whole world. That's our job as Jews, is to be connectors of the divine with all the other nations. So we're supposed to achieve a point of nationhood in which the way we live is as religious functionaries, as doctors, lawyers, street cleaners, mothers, dentists, whatever we do, but that we live in such a way that we're all considered Kohanim, we're all considered people who bear the mission and the light to the whole entire world. Okay, on that I have to run.